Yeah, well, I mean, I think the best way to cultivate godly femininity is to read the biblical stories and see what the women in scripture were up to. You know, there are some really impressive and daunting role models in scripture. There's very few that you see as sort of like sweet and silent. You know, from Ruth to Esther to Jael to Rahab and Deborah, like there's so many that are exhibiting really impressive and amazing strengths. And they're very feminine strengths, right? They're very different from the men. So I think that's the first thing is just we shouldn't be taking our cues from society, no matter which way society is swinging. So if you've got someone saying, you know, women should rule the world on the one hand, and then, or women should be doormats on the other, it's like you don't actually have to listen to either one. You should be looking at what scripture says that a woman should be like, and who are the examples that are held up for us.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Feminine Glory Podcast. I'm one of the hosts of the Feminine Glory Podcast, Lydia Edmonds, and I'm joined by my wonderful co-host, Esther Edmonds.
Hello, everyone.
And we have a very special guest on the podcast today, so let's get right into it.
So we have on the podcast today, Christine Cohen. She is a wife, mom of three, and a homemaker. She's also the director of Camper Down MFA program, and she has also written two amazing books, The Winter King and The Stinking City, which if you have not read her books, you have to stop this episode and go and read her books because they're amazing. We even got our older brothers to read that and they loved it. So definitely, it's not just for females, it's also for males. And we are delighted to have her on the podcast today. So Christine, welcome.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on.
So, do you and your husband also own a restaurant as well? I thought I heard some rumors about that, but I wasn't sure.
Yes, we do. So we started Tapped, which is a tap house down on Main Street in Moscow, 10 years ago. So it's been going strong. It's a elevated pub food and then a bunch of beers and wine on tap. So
nice.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So you've written two fantastic young adult novels, The Winter King and The Sinking City. To start off, what first drew you to writing and then what inspired you to tell stories specifically for young adults, especially with the main character being a female?
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, I don't know. It's hard for me to kind of put my finger on what drew me to writing. I describe it kind of as like an itch that I couldn't help but scratch. You know, it's like it's something that I just have, God has clearly just put in my heart that I love to do. So I remember as young as I can remember, I've been writing stories, usually just for myself or for my family. And then when I became a teenager, I was still writing them almost entirely for me and my sister and my parents. But I was trying to get better at it at that point. I think I even gave one of my stories to my English lit teacher to kind of see what he thought of the story. And so it's just been something that I can't ever not do. And then when I was a teen, I was always looking for good stories with female protagonists. I mean, I read pretty voraciously. It feels like kind of the stale answer to say, like, I write books that were what I was looking for as a teen reader, but that is what it was. There weren't nearly as many books for in the children's market when I was growing up, like the late 90s, early 2000s. That was right when J.K. Rowling was publishing Harry Potter. And that kind of led to a great revival of interest in children's books. That was when publishing said, oh, we can actually make money off of kids' books. People will buy them, so we should publish more of them, which was great. But I was kind of right before that really took off. So there just wasn't a ton out there. And I was looking for books that were that felt like they were challenging me. You know, they weren't talking down to me. I wanted interesting world building. And then I just liked plucky heroines. And so I remember the day that I found Terry Pratchett's books, because he has in the Discworld, his fantasy world, he has this whole series called the Tiffany Aching series. And she is just a very funny, spunky main character. And I thought, oh, yes, this is what I was looking for. And then I found Diana Wynne Jones with Howl's Moving Castle and his Crestomancy series. And he has another great main character in Sophie. And so I just was kind of trying to find books like that. And then when I started seriously writing, I guess the main reason that I wrote a female main character is because I am female, and I figured that would be the easiest for me to write. I've never once been inside a male brain, and so I can't really. It's hard work to try to write from the male perspective when you're female, and vice versa. Mm-hmm. And so I just thought, why not make things easy for me and write for girls with a female main character.
That's great. So that's interesting that you bring up the Terry Pratchett, because interestingly enough, I have not read Terry Pratchett. Neither have you, right? Mm-hmm. Have you read Terry Pratchett? So I really would like to read it. I saw that Gwen Newell was reading it, and I've seen like different people around have been wanting to read it. So that's very, I'll have to pick that book up because I would love to read it.
Yes, I am actually really pleased that there's kind of this resurgence of interest in Terry Pratchett in, I don't know, my circles, because I've always, like I said, since I was a teen, I've loved him. He was not a Christian, but he had a very, he very much had this like jolly view of the world. And so even though his stories have stuff in them that you kind of, you know, you could take or leave some of it, but there's just so many great, like there's so much, there's so many great similes. He has a great sense of humor, and yeah, he's written like, I don't even know how many books in the Discworld series. So usually you can find something that you like of his.
That's awesome. Yeah. So your heroines who display a godly femininity are clearly strong and capable, but you have paired them with strong male characters who display a godly masculinity and do play important roles in their heroine's journey. What made you want to highlight that kind of beautiful dynamic between male and female, especially when so many stories today highlight women standing alone and that type of like feminist character?
Sure. Well, I guess, I mean, in one sense, it's like, I did that because it's true, you know, and all storytellers, we're trying to tell the truth about the world to the best of our abilities. And I do also think that everyone is a bit disenfranchised with the idea of the strong female heroine who doesn't need anybody. You know, I think actually everyone's a bit disenfranchised with the strong male hero who doesn't need anybody either. Like that particular trope, we know that it was not good for man to be alone. We know that community is a vital part of existence. And so so when I set out to write my stories, for one thing, it's like it just is not particularly interesting to read about a character who doesn't need anyone else, because that's not relatable to any of us. And then because I was writing stories, those first two, The Winter King and The Sinking City, are young adult. The main character is 16, 17, which means that in the world that they're in, they're of a marriageable age. And so I thought, you know, I'll be writing a romance in there. So then I just had to think about what kind of a person would be a good fit for their personalities, right? Mm. When you write someone as strong-willed as Cora or Leona, you have to give them someone who can match that energy, right? Mm-hmm. And keep up with them. So that was really, you know, what I was trying to highlight was more just like if the truth about the world, which is that if you have a girl who is strong-willed and opinionated, what she's really going to look for and respect is somebody who's going to be able to match that energy, who's going to be able to push back when she's being idiotic, you know, is able to say like, hey, cut it out, you know, that's actually what is a really a gift to that type of personality. So that was just kind of what I built into Peter and into Nico were those traits, just so that people wouldn't be like, it's kind of like the, speaking of Harry Potter, the Ron and Hermione effect, where you're like, but how will Ron keep up with Hermione's, like, yes. You know, that whole thing never worked for me because I was like, personality wise, she just is going to, you know, run all over him and he's going to hate her for it at some point in their marriage, you know. So spoilers if you haven't read the series. But
so jumping off of the previous question, you also in both of your books have a very needy, annoying female character that is a subplot antagonist. So why did you decide to bring that contrast in comparison between your main female character and this extremely needy side character? And what do you think women today should glean from such a comparison?
Yeah, so both of those side characters so Abalone in The Winter King and Bianca in The Sinking City, I'm guessing, are the annoying female side characters we're talking about here.
Yes.
They both kind of naturally sprang up from the soil of the world that I'd created. And they're different in terms of their relationship to the main character, right? So Abalone and Cora were best friends once. Mm-hmm. So there's a backstory there, right? For both, and then for both of them, I wanted to give Cora and Leona both someone that they would strongly dislike, and then realize that they had misunderstood them, because that is also just a very common human experience where we can dislike somebody based off of first impressions or a longstanding impression or the way that they're acting. And then at some point we realize, oh, like I didn't see what was causing this particular irritation or annoyance, or I didn't understand why they were acting this way toward me. So for Cora, I wanted her to have that moment of realization at the end, right? That she didn't understand why Abalone was avoiding her. She didn't see the underlying fear that was causing her to be so awful. And so I wanted her to have this moment of seeing clearly and pitying her. You know, she's in her nice house with her nice dresses, and that doesn't stop the plague from touching her family. So that ability to feel sorry for someone else, even in the midst of your own hardship, is a really good thing. And it can kind of bring you out of your own self-centeredness. And then for Bianca, that character was there for a few reasons. One was to put into fairly stark contrast, like for Leona, how very much, you know, like a boy she has to be now. So what I was trying to be careful with, you know, writing a cross-dressing character, I was wanting to show that this is something that Leona really hates, that she actually is like, she has to do this. Like, there's some freedom in it, and it's kind of fun to be able to run around without petticoats. But she misses the femininity that she once had. And then, so to see in contrast to that, Bianca, who's got, you know, these beautiful dresses and is acting like a lady and being treated like a lady, like that just opens up for Leona more of interesting scenarios where she has to work through jealousy. Mm-hmm. So that was the kind of her role in the story. And, but Bianca is also a pitiable character, right? And I needed Leona to see that. And I kind of wanted the audience to see that too near the end. At the beginning, they just see her as a flirt and an annoyance. But hopefully by the end, I've kind of shown like, yes, she is that way. But why? Why is she that way? It's because look at the way, as Nico says to Leona, look at the way her father has treated her. So it's not an excuse for her actions, but it at least gives Leona some ability to see like, oh, I actually feel sorry for her more than hatred or annoyance. Like, what I really should feel is pity. And I don't want to turn into her. You know, her father treated her terribly. My father did something that has deeply damaged me, and I could see how I could easily turn into that type of a character. So it's just those types of foils that I think are really good for a main character to have. It is funny though, until you said that, I had not really thought about how I had two annoying side female characters.
No, they're great. I love that ode to kind of to Pride and Prejudice, the first impressions. I think that's great. Yes. But then, so I do have a question. So Abalone is more of a dynamic character. So she does change in the end. She mm-hmm. does some good before. I don't think, maybe it's been a couple of years since I re-listened to The Sinking City, which I couldn't believe. I was like, oh my word, I need to listen to this again. But Bianca doesn't really, she's more of a static character, right? I don't think she really has a full changing moment, does she?
It's not so much I don't think of her as static as much as her change, if it happens, is off screen. Okay. So she, yes, she begins the story where we meet her. She's bitter. She's hurt by the fact that her father doesn't pay her much attention. She doesn't think her prospects are very good. And so she goes and makes this deal with the Seleni, thinking just deeply foolishly, but thinking that they are going to give her something that she wants. And so for her, her moment of self-realization comes at the end when the big showdown happens and she thinks, oh, they're going to honor their side of the pact. And then they're kind of like, look at you. You think this is what we wanted was, you know, you. And so she, it is a moment of shock and realization of like how stupid she's been, how foolishly she's acted. But it doesn't then lead to like repentance, restoration, a blossoming friendship with Leona. And that was kind of on purpose because, well, for one thing, I had done that in the Winter King already. And I think it's more likely that you'd have a character like Abalone, who was once friends with Leona and already has rapport with her, be able to return to like, oh, we can be friends again, as opposed to Bianca and Leona. I just never was really intentionally setting them up to be besties. So for her, I envision that she has, that was the real like bottom, hitting the bottom, rock bottom moment for Bianca, and that after that she changed. We'll see. Maybe she'll turn up in a sequel or something.
So, yes, please. So you brought up the Selene. So I have to know, what was the inspiration for those? Because that was like brilliantly written.
Oh, thank you. Yes. Yeah, so Selene, when I wrote The Sinking City, what I was using as sort of my inspiration was Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, which is an adult fantasy novel by Susanna Clarke that does fairly similar things to what I'm doing, where she's got an alternate historical fantasy. It's Napoleonic England, Italy, and she has a magician's guild. But what she uses for her like sort of other, the strangeness in the story is the fairies, you know, but not like Tinkerbell fairies. It's like the old fairies, the old English fairies, the really scary ones. And so she just does a great job with showing how like you make bargains with them and you pay for it. And it's never like a sweet thing to end up in fairyland. So I wanted to, when I was writing, thinking through The Sinking City, I thought, okay, I want to write something that's like the fairies, but isn't. I just, you know, I wasn't trying to do a complete copying of what she'd done. And so I was trying to think of like, what would be a creature that would be really scary that you could access in sort of a mirror world? Because that's like in England and Jonathan Strange, Mr. Norrell, they access fairyland through mirrors. Mirrors are like portals. And so because I knew I was setting this in Venice, I thought, well, water, that's like the quintessential mirror world situation. So I needed to create some characters that were underwater creatures. After that, I just was sort of diving through some like old myths. The Selene are, it's based off of, Selene is, I think, a goddess from ancient, maybe Italian, like Roman mythology, but it's related to the moon and the tides, you know. So I was just kind of drawing creatures that would have like powers that they're clearly getting from water, moon, tides, all that sort of thing. And I thought it just would be really scary to be living in Venice and know that there was something always underneath the surface.
Yes.
So I guess that's how it came about. I was like, wouldn't it be creepy if...
Yeah, because I mean, even like when you have moments where Leona's going out into Venice and like, I think like at the masquerade ball or whatever, and she's out and about, and it's like kind of like I'm nervous for her, like, but what about the Selene?
I know. They're always, and I think that's the fun thing about those sort of monsters is that it's like they're just right around the corner. Like you never really know when they might show up, which just gives an air of kind of eeriness to the whole story.
Yeah.
I was listening to The Sinking City again, and you had done such a great job reading it out. And I was like, that is what I think the Selene would sound like if you were to actually encounter one. Was it difficult to read that, like to picture what they would sound like and try to imitate that?
Yes. Yes. It was. Partially just because, I mean, I'm not like a trained voice actress. So this was something that Canon was like, you know, it's best if authors read their own books, which I agree with. I always really like it when an author reads their stories. But I'm always trying to strike a balance when I read of not doing like crazy voices, you know, or cause I really don't like audiobooks where the narrator is just being super theatrical. It kind of pulls me out of the story. So I think there's this like nice balance of you're not reading it in some monotone voice, but you're also not like putting on a flamboyant show that distracts from the text. So I was trying to do something where I wasn't like going super you know, I wasn't like I was getting like tin foil and like breathing through it while I talked or something. But, you know, I was trying to do something that felt a little bit different than my own voice, but wasn't super weird. So it was a fine balance. I'm glad you liked it. I can't bear to go back and listen to things I've done. So I have no idea how it turned out.
Well, it was great. It was fantastic.
Good.
So going back to the female lead. So your female lead seemed to embody a kind of Proverbs 31 strength where they're confident, resourceful, and rooted in purpose. Given the cultural pressure to either fully embrace feminism or to retreat into a just kind of be sweet and silent role, how can women push past those extremes and cultivate a godly femininity in a practical way?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the best way to cultivate godly femininity is to read the biblical stories and see what the women in scripture were up to. You know, there are some really impressive and daunting role models in scripture. There's very few that you see as sort of like sweet and silent. You know, from Ruth to Esther to Jael to Rahab and Deborah, like there's so many that are exhibiting really impressive and amazing strengths. And they're very feminine strengths, right? They're very different from the men. So I think that's the first thing is just, we shouldn't be taking our cues from society, no matter which way society is swinging. So if you've got someone saying, you know, women should rule the world on the one hand, and then, or women should be doormats on the other, it's like, you don't actually have to listen to either one. You should be looking at what scripture says that a woman should be like, and who are the examples that are held up for us. I did have someone complain once that Leona was a feminist heroine because she didn't submit to all the men in her life. And I was, you know, but it's like, okay, in her situation, she should not have submitted to a dad who committed her to be sold off to monsters. Like that's actually a time when you get to say no, thank you. And once she's in the house of Mago Ray, she again does not have any obligation to submit to him either. So she's in this unique situation where the men around her have failed her, but it's not an unheard of situation, right? Mm-hmm. So sometimes I think it's just like, we just need a bit more common sense, you know, because yes. I'm against the idea that women should run the world and don't need a man and don't, you know, like all of that is unhelpful and garbage on one side. But, you know, on the other side, it's like it feels weird that we would pendulum swing over to, well, then I guess. So, you know, it's like the worst possible interpretation. If I say, oh, I don't think that women should be pastors and, you know, occupying every high position in government. I actually think that'd really be bad for our society. And then people are like, oh, so you're saying that women should never be seen or heard. And it's like, of course, that's not what I'm saying. That's, you know, it's just kind of an uncharitable take. So I think that we should recognize that God has given women actually just so much ability to shape culture. And so we should be trying to figure out what that looks like and throwing ourselves into that and kind of just not really caring what the culture, if the culture on either side is saying you're doing it wrong. It's that like, love God and do as you please. Are you looking to the role models in scripture? Are you looking at the women around you who you respect and have solid homes and happy children and happy husbands? And, you know, like, are you looking at them and being like, okay, what are they doing? You know, we just have a lot of great examples around us that we can follow. And then we don't have to be scared of either ditch because we know that God has given women really great callings. And so we should figure out what that is.
So if somebody were to go to scripture and then they, you know, read and at the story of Ruth, the story of Esther, the story of Abigail, the story of Jael, and they're like, well, I probably won't have a king come into my tent that I have to put a tent bag through his head. You know what I mean? how would they, or at least I hope not, but how would they glean from that how to be a Jael, but without performing the action? Like, how could they glean to be a type of Jael character, but without knowing that they have to go through that experience?
Yeah. Well, so with something, with any of those situations, or with a lot of those, you see women who are in a situation where society is in danger, right? And they're figuring out how, like, they've clearly been called to do something about it. And I think that that's something that anybody can apply to themselves. We saw that during COVID. Like sometimes what strength was for a woman to go into a grocery store without a mask on and be able to put up with people jeering at you, or, you know, saying, no, I'm not going to get whatever, you know, I can't get you censored with certain phrases, but, you know, there will be no medical intervention happening here. And so, you know, things like that, where it's like you are able to be strong and of good courage, no matter what societal situation that you're in. So I think that, again, it can be kind of narrow-minded or a lack of creativity to say, like, well, because I won't have this one-on-one correlation, there won't be, a king asking me to be his, or not asking, demanding that I be his concubine, or, you know, the opportunity with a tent peg, like, then therefore I don't, there's no way that I can apply that. But it's like, that's just a principle that we're learning here, which is that sometimes women are the ones called upon to defy tyrants. And sometimes glory looks bloodier than we think it should be. And, you know, and also I think that a lot of the women in scripture, one of the things I think is so fascinating is that they're using, you know, the glory of the young man is his strength, right? It is not the glory of the young woman. And I say that as someone who weightlifts. I enjoy weightlifting. However, probably any 14-year-old boy could go into the gym once and, you know, and bench press more than me. Like they just have an ability that I don't have. And so, so then you have to start thinking like, okay, so what is it that we can do if we're ever in a situation where we need to get out, you know, or we need, to conquer or be triumphant. And so that's where, when I give the girls, the protagonists in my story, a lot more of like the ability to deceive in a good way, you know? And that's what you see with JL. You know, she's like, here, come enjoy my hospitality. Surprise! you know, or Rahab with the spies. Like there's certain things that women can do that are a strength, and that is, it's not the same type of strength as a man, but it is still really powerful. And so that's what I'm kind of trying to tap into with the girls in my stories. And also then for the, in your own life, it's like, if you're in a moment of tension or a moment of conflict, like you should be looking at, okay, what can I do? I am not going to win in a fist fight. So, you know, but what could I do to get out of a tricky situation?
So when would you say we lost that dynamic of like strength and yet femininity? Because I know you were talking about this I was listening to a Stories Are Soul Food about the Winter King, and a similar topic got brought up, and you were talking about the kind of underlying theme between a lot of the women in scripture was bravery. And mm-hmm. So because a lot of women today, it's like it is either feminism or we're just so fragile, like we have no concept for biblical strength and femininity together. So when do you think we like lost that?
I mean, I don't want to blame like the washing machine, but there is a sense in which like at some point when we, you think of like the women, pioneer women, or like women in Ireland in, you know, the 1850s, like there was some incredibly strong women who both physically and mentally, the toughness that was required to homestead, to raise your children, knowing that some of them are likely going to die. Like there were so many, throughout history, women have had to be exceptionally strong. And I think that it is a huge gift that we don't have half of our children dying from childhood illnesses, and that I don't have to, you know, cart water from the creek every day to wash my clothes. I'm really thankful for that. But there is something about the revolution of the 20th century when women were given a lot of gifts in the form of technology to assist us in our homemaking and the raising of our children and their health and wellness, you know, all of that, that then for whatever reason, instead of us being like, great, now what else can I do? You know, okay, that's taken care of. I don't have to spend 3 hours on clothing every day. So instead, what more can I do? Instead, we sort of had these like the housewives who, I think, you know, you get the stereotype of the ones that were like, well, I guess I don't, there's nothing else for me, so I will just, you know, eat bonbons and watch television. Or I will just, like it just seems like we sort of went scaled down instead of scaling upward. And so I think that's something that we as women, and I try to encourage women a lot about this, we have an incredible ability to be fruitful and to have that spill out past our homes and into society. And so, you know, the prayer in scripture is, Lord, enlarge our boundaries, right? Like, that's something that I think women could really do more of, is just say, okay, I have, maybe I have, you know, and sometimes it's like, if you have 8 kids, if you have 6 kids, if you've got a lot of little kids at home, then that is your boundaries enlarged. Congratulations. You don't have to try to spill out anymore. You've got a great host here to work with. But if you are, like for me, for instance, my kids are 10, 12, and 14, and it would be weird if I was still trying to stay where I was when they were little. If I wasn't saying like, okay, I've got the kid part. I mean, it's crazy busy, but I've got that. Like, I can do this. So Lord, enlarge my boundaries. Give me something else. And then waiting to see what he puts in front of you and then doing it cheerfully. Like that, I think, is another thing is social media will frequently tell women, like, this is really hard for you and you should spend more time feeling sorry for how hard this is and how thankless this job is. And all of that is actually mental work that's just kind of poisonous, you know, because then you're spending a lot of time being like, feeling sorry for yourself. I can't possibly do any more. And so that's something that I think we should be trying to cultivate is like, okay, I have so many great gifts and also maybe I should spend less time on my phone and maybe I can see what else I can do with my time and energy to bless other people. And that's the weird way the Lord works is he's like, here's another gift. And it's heavy. Here's another thing for you to do. And it's hard. And that's actually a glory and a great way to stay out of trouble.
Yeah. But Christine, if they do that though, they won't have me time.
I know. But maybe the me time, I know, it's like maybe the me time is making the cinnamon rolls. I don't know. Yeah. I don't want to say like there's an unhealthy rat race hustle mentality that I know, like, I don't want to sound like I'm saying you should make your life so crazy that you never have downtime. I'm not saying that. I just think that that's not really the ditch that we're in right now. For most women, I think that we can really do a lot and we could do it without complaining and we'd probably be happier and the little people around us would be happier.
That's true. Yes. Yeah. So speaking of ambition, you clearly are an ambitious woman, both in your home and beyond it. So what kind of mindset do you think women need to develop in order to pursue godly ambition, one that blesses their families and naturally pours out to bless their communities as well?
And yeah.
I touched on that a little bit.
Yeah. So that was kind of what I was talking about already. But I think that one of the things that we have to remember is the ordering of our lives, right? So I say this a lot, but I will say it again. You know, when I'm thinking about my life, it's like, okay, so I'm a Christian first, and then I am a wife, and then I'm a mother, and then I am a writer / MFA director / everything else. Like, and that's the order that my priorities are in. So if something needed to be laid down on the altar for a while, it would need to start with the lower rungs, right? There are non-negotiable rungs in my life. I am not going to be like, well, I will stop being a Christian for a while, or I will stop being, a wife and mother because I want to pursue being a writer. So sometimes actually being godly in your pursuing of ambitions means laying down your certain ambitions because the Lord is saying not yet, or not at the scale that maybe you want to do it. So I love to write. I am ambitious about my writing projects. I would love to be writing more. But this summer, I drove my children to 10,000 sporting events because that was what they were excited about doing. And I wasn't going to be like, no, you may not do baseball because I need more time to write. So it's kind of keeping in check, like, I'm not going to be a miserable mom in order to pursue this thing that truly is lower down on the rung than my children's childhood memories. But on the flip side, I also don't think that we need to fall into like the ditch of thinking that if you're not staring intently into your kids' eyes all summer long, then you're not being a good mom, right? So it's good for kids to have unstructured playtime and to have to figure things out on their own. I'm actually a big fan of like giving a child a recipe and saying, good luck, you're on your own, because I want to see if you can do this. Or, you know, I have definitely told my kids like, hey, I'm going into my office to film a podcast and I need you to not disturb me for an hour and a half. You know, like there's, it's good for them to see you working hard and that you have these things that the Lord has given you, you know, so that we are not raising kids who then turn into being like, well, I was the center of my mother's universe and everything now revolves around me. So, I think it's really good for kids. I give them large stacks of books, you know, and put them around the house so that if one of them says I'm bored and I say, I have many chores for you. And then they wander off, you know, saying, oh, never mind, I'll think of something to do. And then it's like, oh, look, there's some books that I could read. So again, that's the balance that I think we can and should strike, where I want to make sure that I'm checking that I'm not being selfish in my pursuit of these different things. But I also, at the same time, want my kids to develop their own independence and see their mom working hard at something that the Lord has given her.
Mm, that's very good. Mm-hmm. Speaking of children reading, as both an author and a mother, why do you believe it is so important for children to grow up with good stories?
Yeah, well, I mean, stories help us to make sense of the world, right? I think that everyone should be reading. That should be a thing that is part of your life, whether it's fiction, nonfiction. It shouldn't be something that stops when you're done with high school or done with college. Stories activate our imagination, our creativity. They align our loyalties towards the good, the true, the beautiful, if you're reading good stories. And also we are always telling stories. So that's something that we tell a lot of stories in our house, stories about our day, stories about our childhood. You know, you want to make that like a part of your life because it cultivates a really fun family culture where it's like, these are the stories that we tell about, you know, this crazy thing that happened to us on the top of a mountain in Banff at a tea house. You know, we have a great story there. So it's another way of sort of binding and uniting people together. That was why the bards told stories, right? It was like, here's our people and here are the great things that they did. So, you know, we do that with stories from scripture. These are your forefathers. These are the great things they did. You know, here's a story about your dad when he was in the Marines. Here's a story. Like, those are just, they're really good ways to bring people together. So, I'm a big proponent of reading to your kids when they're little, and reading when they're older. All my kids can read, but they still enjoy it when I read books out loud to them. So I'm still doing it.
Oh, that's fun. That's great. Yeah, we're doing, our dad is still reading to us, even though we're all older, he's still reading to us the Chronicles of Narnia. We're running back through that again. And it's so fun to do it all together and to all share that experience. It's a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really is. You know, it's like, it's a way to sort of have like, I remember Nate saying like that, hearing stories or reading them gives you like memories of things that didn't actually happen to you, but it can be like super concrete memory of a thing that even though it wasn't your memory, it was a memory of someone else's story. And so if you're getting that experience around the people you love, like it really does just bond you.
Mm-hmm. And even like kind of points you back to Christ. If the when you rise up, when you lie down, when you walk about, teach your children these things. There have been countless stories that our parents have told us about what God's done for them. And then it's like when we have a trial or we have something, you can think back through those stories, and it's like God's been helping my family for years. It's like, why wouldn't I think He would help me now?
Mm-hmm. Right.
So stories can do that.
Mm-hmm.
So we've touched on this bit already, but how have you woven storytelling into your own family life over the years, and what are some practical ways you would encourage other women, even those who aren't writers, to do the same with their kids?
Yeah, so like I said, you know, reading out loud is huge, especially when they're young. The studies are out there. They, you know, that kids who are read to when they're young enough that you think this feels silly, you know, clearly they're not listening, are just more likely to love stories themselves, to have more success academically, to be just more well-developed individuals. So on that side, it's like, you should just be doing that. That's a thing you should do for your kids. It's a blessing to them. It doesn't matter if you don't necessarily enjoy it, although find books that you do enjoy. There are so many great books out there for kids. And then, like I said, we tell a lot of stories. I try to do fun thing with my kids because I'm a writer. I'm like, okay, I feel like the bar set a little higher for me. So I write them letters each time they lose a tooth. So we have a whole lore set up about the Tooth Fairy. I have like an appendix in saved of like all the different things so that I can keep it straight, because they will call me out on it if I get something wrong, because they remember. So then I've written a few stories just for them that were fun read alouds, you know. Nothing inspires you to write faster than your kids being like, you're reading the next chapter tonight, right? You're like, yeah, I am. But you know, we can all tell the kids, they just like being told stories, and they're very eager to be delighted. So it doesn't have to be a great bedtime story, you know, just come up with something fun and put, insert their names into it. And they will just be so thrilled by that. So, and then, like I already mentioned, I think that going back to unstructured time, if you tell your kids, like, no, you may not have screen time right now, but what you can have is a stack of books and a glass of lemonade and this really nice hammock outside, like making reading something that's just fun. Like, this is a time where you get a glass of lemonade and a hammock, that's going to instill in them a love of reading.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you think the notes to your kids whenever they lose a tooth will make it into a book one day?
I would like them to. They're funny because they are kind of specific, you know, to my okay. kids. So I'm often like mentioning things that we did as a family, or like, you know, I've often wondered, like, would these actually be enjoyable to anyone else to read if they're, you know, if they have bits in them that are like, wait, what is she talking about? You know? So maybe Canon can help me clean them up at some point and release them. That'd be fun.
I bet you'd be really cool. Like, what was it? Father Christmas, what J.R.R. Tolkien did to his kids.
Yeah.
That'd be really cool. Really similar.
Yes. His is nice and short though. I feel like at this point, you know, it's a lot of teeth the kids lose, and then I've got three of them. So
yeah, that would add up. So the early years of motherhood can be exhausting, but they are also such a formative time for shaping a child. Why do you think it's so vital for moms to create a home filled with joy, fun, and laughter? And how can that kind of atmosphere actually serve as some of the best training for our children?
Well, you're creating a theological argument with the aroma of your home, right? Mm-hmm. You've told your kids, in this house, we will serve the Lord. And then you're either showing them how wonderful this is so that they want to follow him too, because in this house, we will serve the Lord. And this house also serves up cinnamon rolls and, you know, snuggles by the fireplace and chocolate and oranges in the shoes and, you know, in the stockings and chocolate in the shoes and, like, you know, all these things. Or you're saying, in this house, we will serve the Lord. And that looks like a grumpy mom and some bland food and very few hugs. So, it really is just you saying, here's the lived out incarnate form of our theology. And so it is a high calling, but an important one, to make that aroma something that your kids are drawn to and that they want to then go and create in their own houses. And it's also just good to remember that it is short. It feels like it's never going to end when you're in the little years. And then at some point you're no longer falling asleep in the laundry basket, like I have done, you know? So I think, part of it is, I think about how sad it would be. My kids are now, like I said, 10, 12 and 14. And it would be really sad if they didn't want to be around me now, you know, like this is kind of the testing point when they're 14, you know, my daughter, is she like, oh man, she's about to get her license in 6 months. And like, if her thought is, oh, I can't wait until I get out of the house, that would be really that would be a failure, a failing on my part.
So why do you think so many moms like don't understand like creating an atmosphere like that? Is it because they have so separated like the scriptural standard for that and creating like a theology in the home? Or is it just that they think they've never been shown that, or where do you think that happens?
Yeah, I think it could be some of both. I think for some people there is that like they've never been shown it. For some people it can be, you know, one of the things I think is always good to remember is you're always building on the shoulders of, you're standing on the shoulders of your parents. Mm-hmm. So there are, I'm sure, some people for whom what they're doing is still better than what their parents did. You know, they're like, well, at least we're not dealing, you know, at least we're not dealing with drug addiction in the house like I had to deal with growing up, you know. So they've got one step. You know, I always want to like handle situations like that with grace, where, you know, sometimes you don't know what you don't know. But then I think on the other side, there are people who, yeah, they truly have divorced that, that the message and the packaging. They don't realize how those two are linked. And so it can be, it just maybe will come as a surprise to them that their kids don't want to be around them, or they haven't seen it. They didn't see it played out in their lives. So they're just not sure how to, you know, implement it into their children's lives. I think that those could be some of it. And then sometimes I think on the harsher side, I think it can be laziness. Because again, we get told, oh, moms, you're doing so much for everyone else. And maybe they actually aren't. You know, that's the funny thing about Instagram reels or whatever, is it's like you never know who's getting this message. And maybe it's somebody who actually isn't doing very much. And so then they're like, you're right, I don't need to do anymore. And it's like, no, wait, you actually do. There probably are some moms who do need to scale it back, but maybe right. You're not one of them.
Yes, right. So on a more historical and personal note, if you could have tea or coffee with any woman from history, who would it be and why?
These questions always feel like like they should be, you know, it's like you only get one. What if I get it wrong? And I right. feel like, you know, the women from the Bible are kind of, they're not a cop out, but like, of course I would like to meet all of them. So instead right. I'm going to go with someone else.
Okay.
Because I was doing research recently on the 800s, 900s in what at that point was called the Kievan Rus area. It's basically Ukraine, Russian area. So okay. 800s, 900s. It was so crazy. Like the level of the tribes, the feuds, the constant strife with both the Vikings to the north and then the traders to the east, traders as in the, or, you know, the eastern trading routes. And then you had to the west, Constantinople, the rise of Christianity. But in that pocket in the middle, it was just like this hot mess of constant like overthrowing and violence and bloodshed. So in that, there was this woman named Olga of Kiev. And okay. she was, her husband was one of the regents of that time, the grand prince or whatever, you know. So he's murdered, and Olga is so angry that she just goes into this rage and starts killing all the rulers of the neighboring tribes in very interesting, crafty ways. She's still quite young, so they also, not only are they terrified of her, but they also kind of all want to marry her, so they keep like trying to send like some sort of, you know, an ambassador to win her. And she's like, and now I shall bury you alive in your, you know, longship or whatever, like, surprise. So she's just so, so fascinating because she's so ruthless. Then she goes to Constantinople and meets the emperor, who is a Christian, and converts to Christianity. And it's like this flipped switch, and all of that, like, incredible energy that she had is suddenly channeled into like, now I want everyone to be a Christian too. So she goes back to the Kievan Rus area and like dedicates the rest of her life to trying to get people to convert to Christianity. So she's actually considered like one of the first, like one of the early saints in like the Eastern Orthodox tradition. I think she's called Saint Olga of Kiev. Anyway, I find her to be so fascinating. I'm thrilled that I get to meet her in heaven. And I just think it would be really fun to sit down and be like, talk me through this conversion process. Like, yeah. It's so wild. So anyway, there's my story and also who I've been thinking about recently that I would like to meet.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah.
Reminds me of Paul, the Apostle Paul.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's crazy. I love
where
that.
The Lord was like, you've got some great energy. Let's direct it the right way.
Yes. Yep. Oh, that's great. For sure. So can you share three books you believe every woman should read and why?
Yes.
Again, you only get three.
See, again, this is like painful. I think that, I always start with Till We Have Faces because it is fantastic. If you are confused by it, I did a series on Canon Press with Joe Rigney where we talked through it. So we explained it so that you can understand it. But to me, it was transformative. Every time I read it, I learned something new about myself, generally not flattering things. So it's just great. The second one, I think that the book Evidence Not Seen by Darlene Rose is her memoir of her time as a missionary. During World War II, she was in a Japanese concentration camp. Women should probably read more autobiographies like this if we're tempted to complain. They are just so good. Such a good wake-up call to be like, yes, I forgot my coffee and had to reheat it three times. Alternately, I had coffee, you know. I was not down to 95 pounds in a camp. So that would be one. And then, you know, for cultivating that mental toughness. And then I think that maybe something like, I don't have a specific one, but some P.G. Wodehouse would be so good. Just for like a sense of humor, you know, so that sometimes, often, at raising kids, you really need a good sense of humor, especially about slapstick situations that happen. And so I think he would be a great one to read to just be like, let's all keep our sense of humor.
Yes, yes.
Do you have a story off the top of your head where you had to keep your sense of humor?
Oh, man. Off the top of my head. Well, you know, just yesterday, actually. So my son, just yesterday, this happened. I mean, this is like when you, and then you start to tell the stories and you're like, these happen all the time. Incidentally, I try to include when I think of them, I put them in my newsletter. So for your listeners, you can sign up for my newsletter at christinedcohen.com and get these stories. But my son started football yesterday. He's 10. He's never done football before. I am given his uniform to put on him, you know, before he goes to his first practice. And we're like, okay, we want to make a good impression. We want to, you know, the coaches are like, these are all the things we want you to, you know, we want you to be tough and on time and all this. And I was like, great, we will be that. My son has played rugby before. And what I am used to with rugby is the equipment that you have is a mouth guard and cleats. That's it. So I think that 20 minutes will be enough time, but they give me the bag full of football and there are like 20 pieces. Like it's like pants, but then there's also these pads and there are more pads than I ever envisioned went into football pants. I guess I don't watch football. You know, and they gave me two sizes of pants. So I'm FaceTiming my husband in a panic. And I was like, tell me how to put the pads in the pants. And he goes, babe, I didn't play football. I don't know. You're going to have to YouTube it. So I was trying to YouTube it and I'm like shoving them in. Meanwhile, we're so late that I'm also driving us to the football practice. And my son is in the back. And I'm having to, we park the car, it's 95 degrees outside, and I'm just pouring sweat, trying to shove these pads in, and he's sitting in the back, and we can see his teammates all over there, like, getting ready for the huddle, and I finally managed to get them in and flipped inside out and get them onto him, And then he's running out and he's like, where's my mouth guard? And I realized at some point in the frantic like tossing of things, I remembered seeing the mouth guard go flying. But we have a big Wagoneer car, and so it's under one of the seats. And I'm in a dress. I mean, I was like, this is the worst first impression, because at that point I have to keep the door open because it's so hot in there. But I'm in a dress crawling through the back of the car. You know, I finally find his mouth guard, and I can just see the coaches sort of watching, like, what's happening. And I'm like, here's your mouth guard. Go. Good luck. But I also, all through all this, we'd forgotten a belt. So he actually was running out trying to hold up his pants. Anyway, it was not the first impression that I envisioned it would be for either him or me, but that's the life. And I actually thought this would probably end up in a Woodhouse story where it's like, ah, there you go. That's what you get for trying to make a good impression. So hot tip for moms out there, give yourself like an hour before you start getting your son into football pants.
Oh, that's great.
Oh, my word, that is so funny. Yeah. Which you also, I saw on your newsletter, you also had a really interesting 4th of July.
Yes.
Kind of funny moment.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You want to expound upon that a little bit
more? Oh, sure. Yeah, that was great. So every year our small town does a 4th of July parade. It's super fun. Because we own Tapped, we usually do a float. And this year, wires were crossed. My husband, I thought that he had said someone else was going to do the float this year. We were up at a lake cabin the week before, so we were kind of busy and out of our element anyway. So we get back into town and we're out at this very nice restaurant the night before. It's July 3rd, 7 o'clock at night. We've just ordered our food and I get my drink and I say, isn't it nice that we don't have to do a float for tomorrow? And my husband, Joel, goes, oh, but we are doing a float. And I was like, oh, okay, so somebody must have decorated the trailer for us. You know, that's great. And he goes, oh, no, nobody decorated the trailer. And I was like, oh, and the candy? Did someone get the candy for us? And and to be fair to him, I mean, he's had a crazy week. We were out of town and he's trying to play catch up on work. So all of this had just completely slipped his mind. And I, who am normally the executor of the float situation, just didn't know that this was required of us. And so he goes, oh, no, I guess we're going to have to get candy, too. And at this point, I'm thinking, should we just leave the restaurant? Like, what are we going to do? But we've ordered our nice food. So, you know, I enjoyed my drink as if it was my last. We ate our pizza. It's like 8:30, 9 o'clock at night. We drive home. The kids are like getting ready for bed. And we said, surprise, instead of going to bed, you get to stay up late and help us decorate a float, which they actually thought was fantastic. Joel ran to Walmart and got all kinds of, well, whatever he could find. Unfortunately, by July 3rd at 9 o'clock at night, it's slim pickings. So we got what we could find. We had it all spread out on our very dark lawn. The neighbor came over at one point and was like, is everything okay? Because we're like, we can't see. You know, someone's trying to hold a flashlight up while somebody else staples the tool onto the float. And our dog is sort of running wildly through everything, like getting tangled up. I mean, it was so chaotic. And I thought, yeah, here we go again. This is just another. It's one of those times where you could either be the mom who is like really angry and annoyed and makes this an unfun situation for everyone, or you can be like, we just have to laugh about this. And, you know, the more you can laugh about the insanity of these situations, the better. So
true.
Yes.
Oh, my word, that's so funny. Oh, I love it. I love good stories like that.
Yes.
So this is another one of those where you're limited to only one question.
Oh, no. Okay.
So what is one trend, either design trend, writing trend, or fashion trend that you just can't get behind, and why?
Ooh. Well, I can't think of I'm sure there's some. I mean, I can't get behind minimalism, but that's just because I think that moms should never be behind minimalism as a general rule. Like, if your kids want to have a really fun house filled with Nerf gun bullets, you should just let them. Like, it's not just your house. But maybe, I guess, okay, here's the trend. And I feel like a broken record, but maybe I'm not at this point. The trend I think of first is AI, particularly using AI for writers. Because when it comes to, like, the Camperdown program, so if you're in the Camperdown MFA program, and you, the, our, policy on it. I guess they asked me to write, you know, the policy for the program. And I was like, yes, I will. My policy is AI is not allowed at Camperdown MFA program. That's it. That's all you get. I think that there is, and I did talk about this in my newsletter recently, but, you know, I don't necessarily mind if you want to ask AI to do something that involves like collecting massive amounts of data and, you know, and compiling it into a study or something. Like, I'm sure there are ways to use AI that are fine. But I think when it comes to the creative life, too much of that is, it's meant to be a struggle. And the struggle is how we sharpen our minds. So you learn so much more from your mistakes than you do from your victories, particularly in writing. And I worry about using AI as a way to avoid making mistakes. Yes, it can be a time saver, but I think it's also just a dulling of our abilities. So I guess would be the trend that I continue to not be behind. It's a hotly contested one, and it's kind of a fun one to, like, you know, argue back and forth. I have some friends who love to use it, and some who are like, it's possessed by demons. And it's a really fun trend to, or, you know, thing to sort of, to talk through. But that's where I land on it, is I'm grumpy. I'm a Luddite.
No, I think that's true. I think that's very well said as well, because I mean, it can be a tool, but then if it's taking away your creativity as a human being, that's not good, because obviously God wanted us to be creative. And so you need to keep your creativity and keep your brain sharp. Cause I think even they mentioned that on a What Have You, of like, especially as you get older, making sure that you keep your brain sharp and not just relaxing your muscles. Mm-hmm. So I think that's really, really good.
Yeah. And I also just think that it would be hard at some point, it would be hard to feel the satisfaction that comes from doing a job well done. You know, if you were like, oh, thanks, but I didn't really do it. You know, I gave a machine a prompt to do it for me. That's something else. And also like the fact that we look at art and we read books and we enjoy movies. And a lot of it comes from the pleasure of being like, I can't believe a human did that. You know, how amazing is it that we can do that? And so once you take out that aspect of it, it's sort of like, but what are we enjoying here? Like, we're not enjoying us as image bearers making art. We're just, you know, we're taking out that very important element.
Yes. Yeah. Cause how sad would it be? I mean, just think about, as you said, if we were like, well, Jane Austen had AI to help her write Pride and Prejudice, and you're like, oh, that would be so sad.
I know. Exactly.
So really quick, I wanted to go back to, this is a little bit far back, but on The Wodehouse, do you have a favorite Wodehouse book, of curiosity?
Oh, gosh. I just recently read Joy in the Morning, and I really enjoyed that one. I really liked Bertie Wooster Sees It Through. I'm trying to remember. I don't know if I have a favorite, actually. I like a lot of them.
I'm trying to get her. She keeps chickens, so I'm really trying to get her to read Love Among the Chickens, because his description of a chicken is just so good. And it's so accurate, too, of how the chicken's like laughing at him. I'm like, that is totally what they do.
Yes.
They laugh at you.
They mock like, you.
Yeah, they do. So what is something that has stood out to you recently that has captured the essence of feminine glory?
Ooh, something that stood out to me recently. You know, okay, well, this is just another book recommend, but I recently read Seeing Green. No, not Seeing Green. The other one. Tilly De La Haye's...
My Dear Hemlock?
My Dear Hemlock.
Okay.
And absolutely loved it. And I thought, this is so amazing, because one of the things that women are like, one of our glories is being able to take something and then make it our own, you know, so that we do that with our houses. We do that with the food we're baking. Like, we're always taking and then creating, you know. And it was really fun to see her take something that's so well-loved, like the Screwtape Letters, and then turn that into something so specific for women. I just thought it was incredible. And I got a lot out of it. I thought I'm going to definitely be rereading this over the years. And, you know, just as a writer, I thought I was impressed by the arc of it, the scope of it. So, yeah, there we go. Another book recommend.
Awesome. Which I do have a question about that. So would you recommend that if you haven't read Screwtape, then you read that first before you read My Dear Hemlock? Because yeah, I know they're not like a sequel, but.
Right. I mean, they're very different. I think that I think they're both great. And I'd probably say, I don't know. I mean, I don't think that you could necessarily say one would either detract or improve the other, but probably Screwtape might be better just so you have the context of like what she's doing, you know, and then going on to Tilly's would be great.
Yeah. So, if your life had a soundtrack, what would be one song on it?
Just one? No.
Just one song.
Okay. When I was maybe 10 or 11, I discovered Edvard Grieg's Peer Gynt Suite Number 1. I don't even know if I'm pronouncing that right. It's a symphony. And of course, there's a lot about it I like, but there's this one piece, I'm sure you would recognize it. It's called In the Hall of the Mountain King. Okay. It starts out very quietly. It's like, do, 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 do.
Yes.
You know that
yes.
one? Yeah.
Yes.
So it starts out very quietly and ominously, and then it crescendos into this utterly frantic, like clashing cymbals and cacophony of noise. And I loved it as a kid. As a kid, I didn't understand kind of the lore that he was building around it, but I knew what a mountain king would be. You know, like I knew there must be goblins. So like I would listen to it and envision like a hero going down into the mountain and then trying to get away from all these goblins. And now when I hear it, I just think of my life. And I'm like, this is kind of how my day feels, where like it just starts out so quiet, but there's always an ominous undertone of football practice is coming up, and suddenly we're in the frantic cymbals and crescendo, and then it ends with someone collapsing into bed. So
that's so great.
Is my that's my soundtrack song.
I love that.
Chaos.
That's so great.
Yeah.
So you are currently working on a new book. What can you tell us about it, and when do we finally get to read it?
Oh my goodness. Okay, yes. So the book that took forever is called The Second Greatest Thief. It didn't take forever because it was hard to write. I actually wrote it fairly quickly, but the problem was I decided to be ambitious and move outside of publishing with Canon Press. With Canon, I sell the books directly to them. I don't need an agent. I thought, hey, I should try selling this one in New York and see if I can do that. But to sell a book in New York to one of the big publishing houses, you have to have an agent. So it took a long time to get an agent. And then we did a couple rounds of revisions on the story before she felt comfortable sending it out to editors. And then it waited with editors for months. And then it finally sold in December of 2024. Now, publishing in New York, usually it takes about 2 years. So they said, okay, it'll come out in fall of 2026, which I was like, all right, I can handle that. It now looks like it's possible that it won't be coming out until spring of 2027. Okay. Which is such a bummer. My editor emailed me and said that was the recommendation from the publisher, mainly because they've really stacked their fall 2026 with a lot of big names, kind of splashy titles coming out, and she was worried that it would get lost in the noise. So at this point, the publication announcement says fall of 2026. I'm sort of telling people like, it may be spring of 2027. We will see. That feels like an eternity. I might be dead. I mean, you just don't know. So it's okay though, because again, this is the story God is writing for this book. And I will just wait patiently and lay down my ambition rather than trying to grasp. So
that's great. Is it like middle grade or a YA? Or?
Yes. So this one is middle grade. So that means instead of having a 16, 17 year old protagonist, the main character is 13 going on 14. And it's set in, again, I just can't get away from these alternate historical worlds. That's what I like doing. So I did a 19th century New York that is steampunk. So that's that sort of fun sci-fi fantasy hybrid where you get like cool like cogs and gears and lots of monocles and strange cats and that are mechanical and, you know, like a lot of just those fun airships. I really enjoy it because it feels like you can kind of just do whatever you want. You know, you're like, I'll just create another invention for that. And the main character is a, she's been raised in the thieving guild. So New York runs, well, it's got a mayor, but primarily it runs through this criminal underground, the set of seven guilds. And she is, has been raised in the thieving guild. She does something real bad at the beginning that threatens to kick her out of the guild. And, in order to stay in, she agrees to take on this really dangerous heist, only to discover that her only remaining family member, which is her older brother, who happens to be the greatest thief in New York, is also going after that same prize. So now she has to run the same heist against him and try to beat him. So it's got sibling banter. It's got a heist, which was really fun to write. I really like it. I'm really excited for it to come out.
I'm super excited for it to come out as well.
I mean, just as you were saying, I was like, I really wanted to come out now.
Yes. Yeah. I'll just wait so patiently.
So who is like your, would you say is like, has been your biggest mentor writing?
Oh gosh. You know, I feel like all my mentors were dead, you know, like I loved, like I said, Terry Pratchett and Diana Wynne Jones, and even Neil Gaiman when he's behaving, his children's stuff, basically. Two books, or three, that I like of his. But I went through the MFA program, the Camperdown MFA program, and Nate Wilson was my thesis advisor. So I learned a lot from him, and I was really thankful for his help. You know, I did Winter King and Sinking City on my own, and I didn't really have a mentor. And that's okay. I think that sometimes you don't necessarily have those. You know who I would say is probably the biggest influence on having me getting to where I was my mom. And that was because she very cheerfully read all my terrible first drafts of everything. So before The Winter King, I wrote two other novels, and I gave them to her, and she was like, oh, yeah. These are nice. Don't publish these. So that was super helpful. Like, she's always been very honest and very, she just has a really good ear for prose, but also a good sense of like, if something's going to work or not. So, I think that probably my mom.
I love that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Christine, where can people keep up with you?
Okay. So as far as the internet, I am, despite all the things I said about Instagram, that is where I spend most of my online time. I think it's Christine Cohen _ author. I think, but I'm sure you could find me. I have a private account that has updates on my kids that you cannot access. So, but the one that's available that's public, I think, is called Christine Cohen Author. And then, like I said, my newsletter, I only send it out once a month unless there's something really exciting I feel the need to share. So that, if you go to ChristineDCohen.com, you can sign up and get updates that way.
Which I love your Instagram presence. It's so much fun. Whenever I see it, I'm like, oh, good, there's a new Christine Cohen story. Oh, no. Can't wait to see what she posted. Like your one about, you were rereading, what was it? The Iliad or the Odyssey?
Oh, the Odyssey.
And you were talking about his thighs. It's and Olympic. I was like, oh, Lord, that is so funny.
I was like, how did I miss this as a teen? Because I feel like I would have thought this was so funny. And then I wonder if it was just Sir Ian McKellen, like the way he's got this like deep purring voice. And so just hearing him being like, and they rubbed oil all over his thighs again. I'm like, again? How many times? I know, it is funny. I am still listening through it. We have moved past Telemachus. We are now on to Odysseus. And we've heard a lot less about his physique. So Homer seems to have gotten it out of his system.
Good. Well, that's awesome. That is so funny. Oh, my word. That had me rolling.
I'm glad.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Oh, yes. This has been an absolute blast.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on. It was very fun chatting with you both.
Alrighty, until next time, keep pursuing feminine glory, and we will see you on the next episode of the Feminine Glory Podcast. Bye, guys.
Well, everyone, thank you for joining us on this episode of the Feminine Glory Podcast. This is the part of the podcast where we're supposed to tell you to like and subscribe to our YouTube channel, mm-hmm. or just subscribe to Apple Podcasts, but particularly YouTube. So there you go. You can smash those buttons and...
Or you don't have to. If you find us boring, if you don't like us, leave you can alone. Just not do that. And not visit this podcast again. It's up to you. Would you rather to listen or not to listen? To subscribe or not to subscribe?
That's the question.
Yep. So you can pick. You can pick. We'll leave it open.
Yes.
You can subscribe. We like YouTube.
Yeah.
Because it hosts our podcast. So.
And YouTube would like us to ask you to do this. So.
So there you go. We asked. So you can do that. Do that what you will.
We'll see you on the next one.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe.
Who knows? All right. Bye, guys.